The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
This episode is brought to you by my friend Rebecca Walser, a financial expert who can help you protect your wealth. Book your free call with her team by going to friendofdinesh.com. That's friendofdinesh.com. Coming up, is Trump coming back to Twitter and Facebook? I'll reveal more about the Biden classified document scandal. It seems that prostitutes are showing up all over the World Economic Forum. That seems kind of weirdly appropriate. I'll tell you why. And Brandon Strock, founder of the Walkaway Movement, joins me to expose ongoing harassment of January 6 defendants even after they've served their sentences. This is the Dinesh D'Souza Show.
America needs this voice. The times are crazy, in a time of confusion, division, and lies. We need a brave voice of reason, understanding, and truth. This is the Dinesh D'Souza Podcast.
It seems like Donald Trump may be returning both to Twitter and to Facebook. Now, I say it seems because Trump isn't back on Twitter yet. He's allowed to be back. Elon Musk has rescinded Trump's so-called permanent ban. Now, Facebook hasn't done that yet. Facebook had a ban on Trump. Well, initially, I believe it was a permanent ban, but then Facebook submitted the case to its so-called oversight board. It's kind of funny. These platforms have these oversight boards, and they act like they're completely independent. I don't believe they are. But nevertheless, the oversight board changed Trump's status to a two-year ban. But interestingly, the two-year ban is up in January, this month, now. And so I've been advocating on this podcast and elsewhere for Trump to go back on Twitter. And my reasoning is really simple. Trump has 80 million followers on Twitter. This compares to something like somewhere between 4 and 5 million followers on Truth Social. Now, if you're running for president, why would you forego a massive platform like Twitter? Not to mention that Trump is perhaps the greatest tweeter of all time. Some people say, well, Dinesh, you're the greatest tweeter. Well, I'm the greatest tweeter when Trump's not tweeting. But when Trump is tweeting, I kind of fall into second place, I have to concede. In any event, the point being, Trump should do it. And he might do it. And he might do it as soon as today or tomorrow, anytime soon. Now, there's an article, NBC News reporting, Donald Trump prepares for his return to Facebook and Twitter. Wow. Now, what does this really mean? Well, evidently, the Trump campaign has formally petitioned both Facebook. Well, he doesn't need to petition Twitter. He's allowed back on Twitter. He just has to start tweeting. But he's petitioned Facebook to lift the ban on his account. And Facebook has replied and said that they will announce a decision in the coming weeks in line with their a process that they have laid out. Trump's campaign in the letter says, "We believe the ban on Trump's account on Facebook has dramatically distorted and inhibited the public discourse." And by the way, quite honestly, this is a kind of election interference of a sort because Trump is running for president. So if you're a presidential candidate, in fact, clearly the dominant candidate in the Republican Party, at least at this point. And so what is the justification for keeping Trump off Facebook? Now, interestingly, Adam Schiff and a couple of Democrats have written to Facebook basically saying, no, you got to keep Trump off. I'm quoting now from Schiff, quote, "Trump has continued to post harmful election content on Truth. That would likely violate Facebook's policies, and we have every reason to believe he would bring similar conspiratorial rhetoric back to Facebook if given a chance." But the simple truth of it is, Facebook took its action in banning Trump in the immediate aftermath of January 6th. They claimed that there was, you know, an incitement to violence or the danger of future violence. I think no one could with a straight face claim that that is the case now. And even when you look at a statement that was made by Facebook, which he's what they're talking about at the end of the banning period, the 2-year period, we will look to experts to assess whether the risk to public safety has receded. Well, duh. I don't think you need to talk to public experts to determine that there is no risk to public safety if Trump is allowed to tweet on Facebook, I mean, allowed to post on Facebook and also to participate in Twitter. So, now, Trump has some restrictions in his agreement with Truth Social. In fact, Mediaite had reported some time ago that Trump had made a deal that he would post first on Truth Social. But I think this is no big deal. He can post first on Truth Social and then set a kind of a 4-hour or 6-hour limit and then post on Twitter and Facebook after that. The main point is to use the platforms and access them for their broad reach, not the idea that Trump has to be first in a particular place. So if he's got some deals with Truth Social, and let's remember, Truth Social was started at a time when Trump had pretty much no social media. He was banned across the board. So it's quite possible for Trump to be on Truth Social and be first on Truth Social, but then also be able to post elsewhere and get his message to the widest possible audience. Guys, Michael Lindell is running a sale on his Giza Dream bed sheets. They're as low as $29.99. Mike promises that the first night you sleep in these Giza sheets, you'll never want to sleep on anything else. The Giza Dream bed sheets are made with the world's best cotton called Giza. It's long staple cotton, which makes the sheets ultra soft and breathable. The sateen weave gives them a luxurious finish, available in multiple colors, styles, and sizes, machine washable and durable, 10-year warranty, 60-day money-back guarantee. So go for it. Call 800-876-0227. That number again, 800-876-0227, or go to mypillow.com. Don't forget to use the promo code DINESH Dinesh. Why hasn't there been an FBI raid on Biden over the classified document scandal? Now, the obvious answer to that might seem to be, well, the DOJ is under the Biden White House. They're part of the executive branch. They're not going to raid Biden for the same reason that you're not going to have a mafia consigliere raiding the home of his boss. But the DOJ is charged with enforcing the law. And the normal procedure with classified documents, let's remember, with the classified documents, the premise is that these are top secret, that only people with clearance should have access to these documents. Ordinary people, lay people, if you will, people who don't have high-level clearance shouldn't be rummaging through these documents, reading what they say, maybe taking photos of them with your phone. None of that. And that's been the FBI's approach with the Trump documents, that even though the FBI told Trump and the people at Mar-a-Lago put an added padlock on the storage room where those documents supposedly were, the FBI goes ahead and raids anyway. And in fact, they raid in such a manner that they push aside the Trump lawyers. They say, listen, leave us to do our job. We're not telling you what documents we're taking, at least not right now. We'll make an inventory and give it to you later. Now, contrast all this with the treatment of the Biden people. Because what's going on with Biden is, well, let's call it a self-investigation. Biden's own lawyers are looking for the documents. Now, you can say at the beginning when they didn't know there were documents, so Biden lawyer finds a document or someone finds it, turns it over to Biden's lawyers, and then the FBI moves in and goes, listen, back off. This is sort of a crime scene. We're now going to be collecting data. We're now going to be looking for the documents. You stay out of it. But no, apparently there's an agreement between the Biden's lawyers, personal lawyers, and the DOJ and the FBI, and the agreement says that the Biden lawyers will continue the search for these documents. So these are people with no security clearance looking for classified material. And the FBI has agreed they're going to be hands off, and the DOJ is hands off, and basically the Biden lawyers will notify them if they find documents. Now again, what is the reason for Biden doing it this way? Well, the answer is really pretty obvious. And by the way, this approach of self-investigation, in other words, we're going to let you discover if you've got any sort of contraband, and then you turn it over to us in good faith. Well, this was, remember, the FBI's approach with Hillary Clinton's emails. They wouldn't grab her computer and say, look, you step out of it. We're going to find your emails and we're going to keep them. We're not going to let you go ahead and delete emails, turn over the ones you feel like turning over. So it's the same deal. And in both cases, what you have is, well, special treatment for the Democrats. The Democrats are allowed to be their own sleuths in trying to ferret out any kind of potentially wrongful conduct that they have committed. Now, there's also a legal reason, a legal benefit that is being given to Biden, and that is, think of it, if your own lawyers are digging up stuff and they come and tell you about it, you're protected by attorney-client privilege, which is not the case if the police come in, if the FBI comes in and they go, hey, what's this? Well, then there's no attorney-client privilege involved. So Biden is given the privilege of being able to control what in legal terms is called discovery. So we don't just mean the, quote, discovery of the documents, but the discovery in the sense here that this is the information that is pertinent to a potential crime that could be alleged against Joe Biden. Now, no one has ever explained why these Biden lawyers were looking for classified documents in the first place. Did somebody else initially spot these documents, which means that they would have presumably read them? Who are those people? Who found those documents? Let's remember, documents have been found now in multiple places. Did the Joe Biden lawyers uncover the subsequent documents? So all of this remains, again, shrouded in mystery. The other thing that's a little bit strange is that there's now a special counsel. So you would think at this point, the special counsel would step in, the Biden lawyers would back off, the special counsel would take over the search for further classified documents, but it seems that to date, that has not yet happened. I also see a report that so far, the Biden administration has offered no response, which is to say no cooperation yet with the House Oversight Committee, which has bombarded the White House with demands and requests and letters that information be provided about all the details of this particular scandal. I'm not saying the Biden people will not have to provide those responses, but to date they haven't. And so if you compare the Trump raid with the Biden, let's call it non-raid, it becomes further a troubling demonstration that there are two standards of justice in this country, and they fall along strictly ideological lines. We all know our digital privacy is under attack. Big tech steals your private information, pictures, chat, and email. This is very bad. So is there a better way? Well, there is. Secure, it's spelled S-E-K-U-R, offers secure instant messaging and email hosted in Switzerland without using any of the big tech platforms and using Swiss privacy laws, which are the strictest in the world. Debbie and I just signed up for Secure and we love it. Secure's proprietary technology allows you to communicate privately without fear of spying from big tech companies, your email provider, or hackers. Use Secure to chat or email with everyone, including non-secure users, thanks to Secure's unique features, Secure Send and chat by invite. Secure is the solution to stop the theft of your digital privacy and identity. Secure is a separate email and messaging application that guarantees your privacy. Go to secure.com, S-E-K-U-R.com, and take back your privacy today. That's secure.com. Use promo code Dinesh to get 25% off for the next 24 months. Secure, S-E-K-U-R.com. I saw a very amusing article in the Daily Mail. This is the London Daily Mail, where you get news that you don't see in the United States. Apparently, there are a whole bunch of prostitutes that have flown into Davos for the World Economic Forum. Now, this is not because they're speakers or attendees. They're apparently providing services on the side. And the Daily Mail interviewed a couple of them. One of them said that, she charges 700 euros, about $760 for an hour. This is, €2,300 euros or $2,500 for the whole night plus travel expenses. Another escort service, which is about 100 miles away from the summit. The manager says she's gotten 11 bookings and 25 inquiries, and there are going to be a lot more coming in this week with the conference in full swing. Now, these prostitution rates seem kind of high. I mean, I don't speak from experience. I'm only speaking from looking at the rate itself. But I think the rates are actually too low, because when you look at the caliber of people at the World Economic Forum, I mean, this is going to be a hard, this is going to be a lot of, you know, these days they don't call them prostitutes, they call them sex workers. And I guess what I'm saying is it's going to be a lot of work. I mean, imagine, for example, being a prostitute servicing Paul Ryan. I mean, this is a guy with the personality of an electric chair. Or Klaus Schwab. Klaus Schwab is the guy who runs the World Economic Forum. I mean, this guy is like 100 years old. I mean, I met Klaus Schwab about 1995. I thought he was around 80 then. I mean, I don't think he was. He probably was in his 60s. I think he's now in his 80s. But imagine being a prostitute servicing Klaus Schwab. I don't feel anything. Or Christopher Wray, the head of the FBI. It's going to be really hard. I mean, I don't know what a prostitute would do with Christopher Wray. This is a guy who probably gets off on like incarceration, torture, things like that. You know, he has the personality of a serial killer. Remember, serial killers get sexual satisfaction from torturing people, their victims. They're sort of sexual sadists, I guess is a word for it. And my guess is that Christopher Wray falls into this category. By the way, some of the people who I think would be, you know, top customers for these prostitutes are apparently not in attendance at the World Economic Forum. For example, Hunter Biden. This is a guy who probably would go nuts. And he's got a lot of Chinese money to go nuts with. And we kind of know from the Hunter Biden laptop that this is a guy who would totally appreciate this environment. He doesn't seem to be at the World Economic Forum. Another notable absence, Bill Clinton. Remember Bill Clinton and the Colombian prostitutes when Clinton had that excited look in his eyes like, whoa. But I don't know, could it be that Clinton is now past that stage? Who knows? Hard to say. The Obamas. Now, the Obamas is really tricky with the prostitution stuff because the Obamas' own tastes and preferences are ambiguous. Well, if you watch Trump Card, you actually know this to be the case. Or don't even worry about Trump Card, I'll cite Joan Rivers. So Joan Rivers was making the point that you've got with the Obamas a really interesting couple. She goes, he's gay and she's trans. So think about it. You've got people whose sexual preferences are, so when you call the prostitution agency, I mean, they're going to have to send them a form to fill out, because otherwise they're just not going to know what to provide. In any event, the thing that's funny about this whole thing is that you've got these, well, let's call them political whores who are over in Davos. And these are guys, you know, they'll sell themselves to the highest bidder. And then you've got the actual prostitutes who are a little more blatant about what they're doing, trading sexual services for cash. But it seems to me particularly appropriate to have this seedy environment in what is, after all, a very seedy international gathering. You want to take the words ouch, ouch, ouch out of your vocabulary? Debbie and I have. We started taking Relief Factor a couple of years ago. The difference we've seen in our joints the past couple of years, nothing short of amazing. Aches and pains are gone thanks to this 100% drug-free solution called Relief Factor. Now, Relief Factor supports your body's fight against inflammation. That's the source of aches and pains. The vast majority of people who try Relief Factor love it. They order more because it works for them. Debbie's a true believer. She's finally able to do the exercises that for a long time she wasn't able to do. So it's been a real game changer for her, her aunt, other members of our family, and for many other people. You too can benefit. Try it for yourself. Order the 3-week quick start for the discounted price of only $19.95. Go to relieffactor.com or call 833-690-7246 to find out more. That number again, 833-690-7246, or go to relieffactor.com. You'll feel the difference. Guys, I'm really delighted to welcome to the podcast my friend Brandon Strzok. He's the founder and leader of the Walkaway campaign. He was also involved in January 6th proceedings, and that's really what I want to talk about. Brandon, welcome to the podcast. I mean, this whole business of January 6th seems to have changed your life and changed the life of a lot of other people. Now, it's one of the fundamental principles of justice that you shouldn't torment people before they're convicted of something. And second, when someone has done their time, paid their debt to society, they should be left alone and allowed to resume their life as normal. But that is not the case with the January 6th defendants. And I'd like you to explain a little bit about your own experience to show how the Biden DOJ and these guys have been continually tormenting you and others.
Right. Thank you for having me. And yeah, I would actually argue that you're also not supposed to torment people after they're convicted either. You're just kind of not supposed to torment people in general. But so the moment that people are arrested by the DOJ in these January 6th cases, they go on to essentially a registry, which I liken to a sex offender registry. And I know that sounds really extreme, but here's the thing. Google my name. Google the name of any January 6th defendant. And what you're going to find is the very top first search result is a dossier that's compiled by the government of a complete breakdown of every detail of the case. And what's really peculiar, too, is that in my particular case, they also include a 1-800 number at the bottom. So if you want to call in and include more tips or more information, they provide the number for you right there where you can directly contact the government with more information to provide for the dossier in my case. But it's really twisted and it's really sick because let's just take my case, for example. They charged me initially with 2 felony charges and a misdemeanor charge. Now, to remind you and your audience, I never went inside the building on January 6th. I was never, even by the government, I was never accused of any violence, vandalism, theft, or destruction. I was merely accused of occupying restricted grounds and of disorderly conduct, this type of nature, things like that. So as we worked through my case, and by the time we got to my sentencing, which took almost entirely a year, when we got to the last hearing before my sentencing, the judge asked the prosecution in my case about felony charges. And the prosecution told the judge, you know, after we had an opportunity to talk to Mr. Strzok, now this is long after they charged me, FBI raided me, put me through hell, everything else. The prosecution tells the judge, we really didn't have evidence to charge Mr. Strzok with any felonies. So we feel that a misdemeanor conviction is appropriate in his case. Okay, I would argue that's bad enough, except for guess what? They haven't changed any of the information that's in this dossier on the registry. So when people Google my name and the first search result pops up, Brandon Strzok, Department of Justice, January 6th, they click that link. And what do they see? He was charged with this felony. He was charged with this felony. He was potentially facing a third felony. He pled guilty to this misdemeanor charge. It sounds horrible if you read all of this. And people are reading this because literally just days ago, I was applying for a new payment processor for a business venture that I'm going to be launching in a couple of weeks. They wrote us back saying that they were denying my application to use them as a payment processor. And they directly stated, direct quote, due to your involvement and conviction related to the January 6th Capitol riot.
Wow. So this business of putting out a public registry in which you're listing all the people who are charged, you're providing details of their case, I mean, that's not normal for the DOJ, no. Right? So this is, in other words, isn't it reasonable to infer that they're doing it precisely in order to make a public spectacle and ruin the lives of the people who are being listed, because this is going to affect them if they apply to rent an apartment, apply for a job. In your case, of course, apply for the kind of tools of entrepreneurship that you're looking for. So I think the larger point you're trying to make here is that, number one, you've got information out there that has become detached from the actual facts of the case as they were weaned down. Right. And yet, number two, this is a kind of second conviction. And what I mean by that is they're now trying to ruin you in your normal everyday activities as you try to go on with your life.
Yeah, it's collateral punishment for what is supposed to be a misdemeanor case. And to your point that you made during my introduction, I would argue that I paid dearly for this Class B misdemeanor charge. Now, I have no prior criminal record. This is my only conviction on my record. And for this Class B misdemeanor charge, I spent 2.5 days in jail, 3 months on house arrest. This is my sentence, three months house arrest, 3 years of federal probation, 60 hours of community service. I was given the maximum fine of $5,000. I was ordered to pay $500 restitution to the Capitol, although it was acknowledged that I didn't engage in any destruction or vandalism to the Capitol. And I was also given court-ordered mental health services as part of my sentence. Now, I'm going to be on federal probation until the year 2025 on my Class B misdemeanor charge. But I have served every aspect of my sentence. I paid my fines. I paid my restitution. I did my house arrest. I spent my time in jail. The only thing that remains at this point is the remainder of my probation. And I have no reason to believe that I will be committing any more crimes or violate my probation. So for all intents and purposes, I have served a very harsh sentence for this misdemeanor charge. And I would like to move on with my life from this thing that happened more than 2 years ago. But they won't let it go. And I think what's so disgusting and really aggravating and infuriating is that, you know, here we are all this time later, and they're trying to, I think they're already stretching the bounds of the law in all of these cases, charging people, a lot of people, with this felony charge of obstruction of Congress. This is that charge has never been used that way in the history of law. They literally they had to get permission from the federal court to use this charge in the way they're using it against January 6th defendants. Now, I managed to avoid that charge because, again, I took a misdemeanor plea deal. But it's like, it seems like that's a happy ending. Okay, you get a misdemeanor conviction, but you don't get to move on with your life. They're finding many, many, many creative ways to punish people far outside of that conviction and the sentencing process. And it does have a lot of real world effects, whether and all of the things that you named have happened to me directly, not to mention probably every other January 6th defendant. I have been denied apartment applications. I have been denied payment processor applications. There are January 6ers who have been debanked entirely. I have been banned by email services, by donor portals, by so many things because of January 6th. And they tell you. I mean, they tell you, they say, due to your involvement with January 6th, due to your conviction, they're finding this out by doing a Google search. And yeah, let's not pretend like there's not 30 pages of horrible articles about me, too, certainly. But when you see there right at the very top, a website directing linked to the United States government that has a dossier full of links. And again, to repeat the point, things that they accused people of. And then they dropped those accusations. They dropped my felony charges. They stated in court, we actually didn't have enough evidence to charge him with felonies. Yet it remains in my dossier, all of the felonies that I was charged with.
Ron, and this is absolutely outrageous. And it really shows you the way in which they're doing this just to serve their, you know, vicious narrative. Because you can't say insurrection without treating people as insurrectionists. And that's actually what they're doing. By the way, I want to give out your website. It's brandonstrock.com, BrandonStrakA.com. It's also walkawaycampaign.com. Hey, Brandon, thanks for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Dinesh.
My dad wasn't a big believer in the stock market. He was a put your money in the bank kind of guy. But I discovered in the early 1990s that investing in the market makes a lot of sense if you're in it for the long term. Problem now is we're in a rocky economy, lots of craziness at home, instability abroad. There's always the risk of a black swan event, a kind of unanticipated event that comes out of nowhere and basically decimates your savings. So how do we take advantage of the upside of the market and protect ourselves against the downside? We need some really good guidance here. And my friend Rebecca Walser, she's a tax attorney and wealth strategist with her MBA from the London School of Economics. Rebecca and her team can help protect your wealth during these unprecedented times. So go to friendofdinesh.com and book your complimentary introductory call today to see if you qualify. Again, that's friendofdinesh.com. I just saw a comment by Myra Flores that caught my eye. It says, if we are pronounced dead when our heart stops, why are we not pronounced alive when our heart starts? And I was thinking about this, and I thought, this is very interesting, because there is, in fact, a definitive determination of death. And that is the clinical shutdown of your vital organs. So people talk about the phrase brain dead, for example. Your brain is shut down. So if your heart is shut down, your brain is shut down, you're pronounced dead. And Myra Flores' point is that if science is able to make that kind of a call, this guy's dead, he's no longer alive, he's now dead, why doesn't the opposite of that signal the beginning of life? In other words, your heart starts, your brain is not functioning. Now, this comment by Myra, I shared it on social media, and of course it pulled some people to comment on it, and one guy weighs in and says, false premise. Just because your heart stops doesn't mean you're dead. Hearts can be restarted. Ask all those who have survived a cardiac arrest. Now, this is true, but sort of beside the point. And here's my reply. What about if your heart stops and stays that way? You're dead. Myra's point is that the opposite is true if your heart starts and keeps going. In that case, you're alive. Now, there's a woman on social media. Her name is Regina Mauro. You can follow her on Twitter at Regina, M-A-U-R-O. And she picked up a piece of legislation that codifies death and modified it. She calls it the Proposed Amendment to the Uniform Determination of Death Act. And essentially what she says is, why don't we modify this Uniform Determination of Death Act to be a Uniform Determination of Death and Life? And so the Uniform Determination of Death Act says, for example, that determination of death is based upon, quote, irreversible cessation of circulatory and respiratory functions, or irreversible cessation of functions of the entire brain, including the brainstem. And what Regina Moore does is she puts in the reverse, determination of life. Only an individual who has sustained either circulatory and respiratory functions or the functions of the entire brain, including the brainstem, is alive. And the point being, she took this proposed amendment and sent it out to legislators in the 50 states, and so far, like, dead silence about it. Dead silence about it because, of course, the problem with this whole abortion debate is nobody wants to see logic through to its conclusion. Nobody wants to say, all right, let's look at the fetus inside the womb. We agree that geographically the fetus is inside the mother. But on the other hand, we also have to say that the fetus is developing its own, not just its own DNA, its own fingers, its own toes, its own heart, which is generating a heartbeat. Now, some of that doesn't kick in until several weeks. I believe in the heart, it's about 6 weeks. Do you know, honey, if it's 6 weeks or so, roughly 6 weeks when you get...
Flutter at 5 weeks.
Yeah, so a flutter at 5 weeks, a heartbeat at 6 weeks. And so what we have here is science, which is kind of definitive at one end of life, declaring, yeah, this person's completely dead. Yet on the other end of life, suddenly going into a kind of agnosticism. And I guess the point I'm trying to make is that it's not because the science can't speak to the issue. On the contrary, there's pretty good knowledge that if life ends because of the cessation of these functions, the resumption of those functions at the other end of life, in other words, at the beginning stage of life, should be definitive proof that life is now begun. And of course, we're obviously talking about human life, right? I mean, no one's going to claim that it's a lizard or something else in the womb. If it is life, it has to be human life. And if human life deserves protection, and who would argue that it doesn't, then why doesn't it deserve protection in the womb as it deserves protection anyplace else? I'd like to invite you to check out and subscribe to my Locals channel. Now, I've got a whole bunch of first-rate films up there for annual subscribers. Each one is handpicked by me, and Diabetes are powerful, moving films of the kind that Hollywood hardly ever makes anymore. Films like 2000 Mules, Long Road Home, which is the Johnny Cash family story, The Stoning of Soraya M., an unforgettable film starring Jim Caviezel, Sabina, a beautifully shot film set in Nazi-dominated Romania with an unforgettable Christian message. Many more films going up in 2023. My films, as well as great films by others, you can watch all of them just by becoming an annual subscriber to my Locals channel. It's $50 a year. That's less than $5 a month. Plus, you get other exclusive content, including my weekly live Q&A. Sign up at dinesh.locals.com. I'd love to have you along for this great ride. Once again, it's dinesh.locals.com. I'm talking about the Galileo case, and I began by describing how before Galileo in the ancient and medieval world, the belief was that the earth was the center of the universe and the sun went around the earth. This is the so-called geocentric theory, and it seemed to conform to ordinary experience, which is our experience is that the sun rises and sets, not that the earth is moving, but the sun appears to be moving. Now, Galileo was a Florentine astronomer from Florence, highly respected, and he was once a supporter of the Ptolemaic geocentric theory, which, by the way, did conform to a lot of empirical observations. But eventually Galileo became convinced that Copernicus was right and that the Earth revolved around the sun. This is the so-called heliocentric alternative. Copernicus, by the way, had advanced his theory about half a century earlier, in 1543, in fact, in a book dedicated to the Pope. And Copernicus said, look, I don't have any physical proof. I mean, remember, this is a time when you couldn't, you know, go in a spaceship and see the Earth going around the sun. So Copernicus goes, I don't have any direct proof, but the power of this heliocentric theory is that it produces better predictions of planetary orbits. In other words, if we assume that the sun is at the center, the Earth goes around, we'll be able to calculate more accurately the orbits of planets. Now, this created a big debate in the religious and scientific community, which, by the way, at the time was kind of the same thing. In other words, it was clergymen who were doing science. The scientists who were operating at the time were mostly affiliated in some way with the clergy, if they were not priests or bishops themselves. And there was a debate over the Copernican theory. But interestingly, Copernicus didn't really get in any trouble over his theory. And the general view was that, look, Copernicus is onto something very interesting, very important, very useful for calculating the motions of heavenly bodies, but not sort of definitive or persuasive enough to sort of throw out the geocentric theory altogether. Now, Galileo comes in, and he makes some contributions to the Copernican theory. He advances the debate further. in support of the heliocentric hypothesis, let's call it. But Galileo's arguments, again, are valid, but not by themselves decisive. In fact, a couple of his key arguments, as we'll see, were also mistaken. And today there's a mythology around all this, so we have to sort of remove the mythological aspects to what Galileo actually did. One of the mythologies is that, well, you know, Galileo went to the tower, the Leaning Tower of Pisa. He dropped heavy and light objects to the ground, you know, large objects, small objects, and he noticed that, hey, all the objects, whether large or small, whether more massive or less massive, nevertheless hit the ground at the same time. And this is sometimes told today to say, well, one simple experiment sort of refuted centuries of medieval theorizing. Well, except that this is not even true. Galileo didn't do that. One of his students conducted an experiment in which the student dropped heavy, more massive and less massive objects. And guess what? The more massive objects hit the ground first, which you and I can verify by doing it ourselves. If you go up to the top of a tall building, take a more massive and a less massive object and toss them both off, you'll notice the more massive object hits the ground first. Why? Well, basically, it's because of air resistance. In other words, air resistance gets in the way of being able to do a perfect experiment. What Galileo was getting at is that more massive and less massive objects will, in the absence of air resistance. In other words, if you drop a more massive and less massive object in a vacuum, then yes, they will hit the ground at the same time. But Galileo didn't come to this conclusion based upon experiments performed at the Tower of Pisa or anywhere else. He did it on the basis of some rather complex deductive reasoning that we don't need to go into here. But here's Thomas Kuhn, the historian of science. He goes, to verify Galileo's law by observation demands special equipment. In other words, you have to create a vacuum. Galileo himself got the law not by observation, but by a chain of logical arguments. Now, Galileo developed a more sophisticated telescope, and people were able for the first time to see farther and see more clearly. He made some important new observations about the moons of Jupiter, the phases of Venus, spots on the sun, and all of this sort of undermined the Ptolemaic theory and supported the heliocentric theory. But as I will point out in the next segment, all of this was interesting and it tipped the balance toward the heliocentric theory, but it didn't settle the issue. In the last segment, I talked about how Galileo came up with new observations, observations about sunspots, observations about the phases of Venus, observations about the moons of Jupiter, and all of this pointed toward the accuracy, the validity of the heliocentric theory. So Galileo takes his observations to the Jesuits, and the Jesuits are an order of the Catholic Church, a very intellectual order, sort of the way the Dominicans are, and the Jesuits were known to be the best astronomers of the day. So the Jesuits say, all right, let's take a look, Galileo. Let's see what you got. And they look in Galileo's telescope. They go, wow, this is an amazing telescope. We can see things we couldn't see before. And the Jesuits agree that the new evidence produced by Galileo does strengthen the case for the heliocentric theory. But the Jesuits go, it doesn't prove it. It moves us in that direction, but it's not definitive. It's not decisive. We're not convinced, let's just say, beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, the Jesuits aren't alone in this. Tycho Brahe, who's the greatest living astronomer of the period, Galileo would subsequently surpass him in reputation, but at the time, Tycho Brahe was highly respected, and he's not convinced either. In fact, Tycho Brahe holds on to the geocentric theory until his death, and he prevents a lot of scientists from switching over to the heliocentric theory because of his great reputation, Tycho Brahe's great reputation. Now, what about the Pope? It may be surprising to find out that the Pope was actually kind of a fan of Galileo's. I say this because when you think of religion clashing with science, you think the Pope is some sort of an unscientific ignoramus. But no, the Pope actually liked Galileo. The Pope supported scientific research. In fact, a lot of the scientific research was done by the Jesuits and others in observatories that were owned by the Catholic Church. So this is not a case where the Church was sort of anti-science or even against new information. Not at all. Galileo had a meeting with a very intelligent man. This is Cardinal Bellarmine, who was in charge of the sort of maintenance of Catholic doctrine. And this is a very interesting meeting that occurred as a result of the Inquisition. The Inquisition taking an interest in Galileo. Was he contradicting the teachings of the Church? And so Cardinal Bellarmine, the meeting was sort of to look into this matter. Now, Galileo comes to Rome. And you might think he's in handcuffs or he's somehow been corralled by the Inquisition. Actually, no. He comes to Rome with great fanfare. He's treated as a celebrity. In fact, he lives in a Medici palace while he's there. And he meets with Bellarmine. And this is what Bellarmine concludes at the end of that meeting. And I say this because I think that this statement from Bellarmine is actually almost a model of a thoughtful way to respond to a kind of new argument that is presented to you. Here's Bellarmine talking to Galileo. He says, "While experience tells us plainly that the earth is standing still," Bellarmine continues, "if there were a real proof that the sun is in the center of the universe and that the sun doesn't go around the earth, but the earth around the sun, then we should have to proceed with great circumspection in explaining passages of scripture which appear to teach the contrary, and rather admit that we did not understand them than declare an opinion to be false, which is proved to be true." So what's Bellarmine saying? Bellarmine's saying that if you read scripture, it appears to speak in the colloquial language that suggests that the earth is stationary and the sun is moving. And that's what we've been teaching because that's what scripture appears to say. But Bellarmine goes, if you, Galileo, have real proof that that's not the case, and that the sun is at the center, Bellarmine goes, well, then we obviously have been misunderstanding scripture. We've got to very cautiously admit that, listen, these are some new facts. They've made a new case. We now have to reinterpret those scriptural passages because we've obviously been getting them wrong. We've been taking, you may say, the colloquial or surface description of things, the way things appear to us, to be the fact of the matter. But, Bellarmine continues, "but this is not a thing to be done in haste. And as for myself, I shall not believe that there are such proofs until they are shown to me." So Bellarmine is unconvinced. He goes, yeah, you're making good points, but you haven't clinched the case. So we're not going to change 200 years of scriptural interpretation because you have a new theory. It's only a theory. So in any event, Bellarmine doesn't want to shut down Galileo's research, so they come to a sort of compromise. Basically, they agree that there's no real conflict between scripture and science, or between scripture and nature, the laws of nature. Bellarmine tells Galileo, you continue your research, but until the case is proved, you should not publicly advocate the heliocentric theory. In other words, do this as a conversation among astronomers. Let's say we call it today, keep it in the academic departments. Keep it a matter of expert opinion. Don't go around telling people, hey, listen, it's the earth goes around the sun, because we don't want to have public confusion. Is scripture right? Is science right? So let's avoid this until the matter is settled. Let's keep it in the academic departments. Galileo agrees. And in fact, signs a document basically saying that he will not do this.
Subscribe to the Dinesh D'Souza podcast on Apple, Google, and Spotify, or watch on Rumble, YouTube, and SalemNow.com. three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.